Well, we probably won't get into lesson four tonight. We'll read the book. But I feel like the stuff that we've done covers some of that in lessons four and five. And I hope it's been rewarding to you. I always love to do these open mic situations where we get more people engaged, and it's been fun, and I hope that you've enjoyed that part of it. The communication point is very good for us to discuss. We'll get into that in a moment, but I want to, how many of you have heard of the Peter Principle? Okay. I love his statement. He says, in a hierarchy, every employee tends to rise to his level of incompetence. Think about that one for a moment, huh? It's so true. It really is true. Moses is a case in point here. A lesson in leadership. Jethro, his father-in-law, suggested three facets of Exodus 18. Serve as a mediator, communicate God's will, and delegate responsibility. I believe that to a great degree, that's what we're involved with as elders and leaders in the church. And when it comes to delegating responsibility, what we're doing there is we're honoring the worker, if I can use the term worker, business term in this sense. We're honoring the worker when we delegate, because there's a process to go through. And what Jethro was saying is you can't handle all this, you see. Now, sometimes our ego is fed, I think Moses was too, but have all this responsibility, you know, a couple million people, and they're all crying up to him, please help us, what have you. And he's trying to handle it all, but there's kind of an ego trip there. But Jethro says you can't do that. You do a disservice to the congregation by trying to solve all these problems. And so delegate to some other people to do what they can with the smaller problems, and you do the larger ones. Makes sense. Yet I've known leaders that couldn't delegate because they wanted the responsibility, because it kind of put them on a pedestal. It made them feel good about themselves, and what, you know, there was a certain pride factor involved in being responsible for this, that, and the other thing. But you see, when we get to the point when it's a prideful thing that we want to be responsible for everything and don't really want to delegate, it's also a situation where it's a control thing. And it becomes a control thing, and what it does is it diminishes the growth of the worker. It diminishes the empowerment of the worker. And so the worker doesn't really grow. But maybe the elder or the leader is enjoying the status that he has, but in reality, the job doesn't get done. And that's what Jethro was trying to get across to Moses. It's just not getting done. People aren't getting, their needs aren't being met. You know, sometimes people have a problem with me on this because they say, you talk about needs all the time. And, you know, I think we are a people in America that we're spoiled, you know, we're having all our needs met all the time. And I said, I'm not talking about that kind of need. I'm talking about real needs. I'm talking about real spiritual needs. Jesus said we don't have to worry about having a cover over our heads and the food to eat and all that. That's going to be taken care of. And when it gets past that, it's wants. The microwave, garage door opener, you know, that, those are wants. I'm talking about real needs spiritually. And we all have needs spiritually. We have the need to grow. We have the need to be recognized. There's nothing wrong with that. Significance is a powerful drive in human nature. Sometimes it's not recognized as powerful as it is. I mean, the desire to eat food, when you are born, you come into this life, you're almost a blank slate. There are certain instinctual drives. I mean, you have to desire to eat, which is instinctual. You will desire to move your body around, which is just crawling for a while, whatever, that's instinctual. You have a desire to speak and somehow communicate, that's instinctual. And even potty training, to one degree or another, you're going to do it one way or the other. If you're trained to do it or not, that's instinctual. What is also instinctual in the human psyche is the desire to feel significant. Now, whether you like that idea or that concept or not, whether you think that's selfish and self-centered or not, that's exactly the way it is. And if you talk to any social scientist or psychologist that had a lot of experience in this field, they'll tell you that everybody desires significance, everybody. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, I think that God has based his whole plan of both salvation and the work of the church on the sense of building up and empowering the individual worker. That's giving them significance. If you have a worker that's not feeling significant, he's not going to be a worker very long, or she's not going to be a worker very long. If you have a worker that doesn't feel empowered by you as a leader, doesn't feel like you care about their needs, they're not going to be very productive very long. And if they're cut out of the process because you want all the glory, or you want to do all the work, or you want to be in charge of everything, they're not empowered. And what you have now is disunity. So meeting their needs is basic. It's basic in the family. It amazes me sometimes how many fathers and mothers don't make it a basic drive for them to meet the needs of the children. Not wants now, but needs. And that's why we have dysfunctionality in our homes, and we have dysfunctionality in our churches. And I'll talk about that in just a moment. So anyway, he delegated responsibility. The attitudes that cause burnout are pride, guilt, inability to say no, lack of recognition. Those four primarily, psychologically, cause burnout. If I'm so proudful that I want to get all the attention, I'm probably going to get burnt out somewhere. Or have you ever known the guy that's always responded to the invitation? They don't do it much anymore. I remember years ago at Lakeview, we had one guy there, good man. And he worked with our bus program and everything. But every other Sunday, he'd respond to the invitation. I don't feel worthy. You know, please pray for me. I feel guilty. Blah, blah. He had false guilt. And sometimes false guilt can drive us towards burnout. I mean, I work with people in counseling that have false guilt, you know. And some that have had abortions, or some that have done something terrible in their life, or have lived a very ungodly, worldly life, and now that they're Christians and baptized, they don't believe God ever really forgave them, and therefore they can't forgive themselves. They really struggle with forgiveness. They really struggle with God's grace. They just don't believe they're worthy of it. I know one woman that I was working with over a period of time, and I didn't see her very often because I was traveling a lot. I didn't see her as much as I wanted to. Eventually, she committed suicide because she didn't think she was worthy. And boy, that tore me up. Of course, then I blame myself. You know, I didn't do what I was supposed to do, or all that I should have done, and what have you. But these are the things that cause burnout: inability to say no, people pleasers, you see, and the lack of recognition, always striving for recognition. You ever had the good sister that said, you know, you put a list in there of all the people that helped on the workday, but you didn't put mine in there? Ever had that problem? And my excuse is, well, you know, I couldn't remember everybody. Well, you should have. Because I worked all day. I worked longer than anybody else on work day. If I'm going to recognize somebody, I got to recognize all of them. Now, I could get kind of, you know, upset about that and condescending about it and all that, but no, that's not helping this person. They need recognition. We all do. It's a big, big drive in our lives. And it needs to be fulfilled in a godly way, not an ungodly way. So these are the things that cause burnout, drive us. But here's my point. Ministry should be joyful, not burdensome. Not burdensome. If ministry is burdensome, then there's something wrong. Either I'm involved in a ministry where my gifts aren't being used, I'm not being recognized for what I do, I don't agree with the overall plan and mission statement or what have you, for some reason I don't fit in this ministry, then a good leader will find a ministry you fit into. You don't put square pegs in round holes. In my book, I talk a lot about involvement ministries, and I make the point, involvement ministries, just like you see in Acts 6, are for the purpose of carrying out something that an individual themselves can't carry out. And they also fulfill the need to be recognized, and they also fulfill the need to use your gift. We'll talk about that a little bit more in this communication process. The principle of boundaries. Now, we've already talked about this a little bit. The young man had brought this question up. And here's the two Greek words I was talking about. We place limits on how others influence us. We have to do that. That's a big problem for people in dysfunctional families, because they have this tendency to want to be people pleasers. And so they can't say no. And sometimes that's a big problem for an elder or preacher. When I became an elder, one of our elders, much younger than me, but a good man, good elder, loving elder. But in the past, you know, a couple of people always go to him. You know, we need money for this. And so he said, oh, yeah, go ahead. So pretty soon they ignore the other elders. Some of you elders maybe have experienced this. And so one day I said, what's going on here? You know, so I talked to him a little bit. I said, you're making decisions that the rest of the elders aren't even in on. And you're spending money that the rest of the elders don't. He said, well, we've done that for a long time. I said, we got to stop it. You know, you're just the new guy on the block. Yeah, but I'm older than all you guys are. I'm just kidding. And so I said, we got to stop it. He said, why? Because you're overburdening yourself. He's getting involved in all kinds of ministries because nobody else seems to want to do it. Is that really the truth? Well, it's too much effort to go get other people to do it, and so it's just easier for me to do it. And he's enjoying the status it gives him. I said, good man, I love him to death. But he had to see that in himself. And these people had to stop going to him to get decisions made that favor them. You ever had kids that way? You know, if mom and dad do that, if dad says, okay, little sis, she's a cute one, you know, and so every time she goes to daddy, I want this, and junior, he doesn't get much. You got dissension in the ranks, folks, and you're going to have some problems with those kids in the future. Same thing with elders and the members. Don't find an elder you just go to because you know he's going to favor you, just like little junior assistant they do, you know. Things that are of a nature that have to be decided that's on the eldership level. Now, if it's a decision that a deacon make, then go to the deacon. Don't bother me with it. But if it's on the level the elders have to make a decision because this elder's making the decision, let's bring it to the eldership. He stopped doing that. And they started crying and complaining about it, you know, but finally. And it's amazing how he grew from that experience. And it was a relief to him because he was burning himself out. But he couldn't say no, you see. And so we're helping him as an eldership. We help one another. That's what a body does. When one part of the body is kind of weak, then the stronger helps. He doesn't destroy, put down, intimidate, whatever. He helps. That's what shepherds do. And so you have to understand this basic principle of placing limits and enabling. Enabling is self-destructive. I see it all the time in counseling. Because people come to me, I don't have any functional people come to me for counseling. Isn't that a surprise? Okay? They all are dysfunctional? After a while, I get together with some other psychologists sometime. We talk about this thing, you know, and one guy said, the whole world's dysfunctional. I don't care. They're all dysfunctional. You know, well, he sees the world from his perspective, you know. We'll talk about that in just a moment. What makes dysfunctionality? But this is a very important principle. I've had people come to me in their 40s that say their wife, their mother or their father have constantly enabled, they've been constantly enabled their mother or father. And they're in their 40s, married, got kids, and mom or dad will call them up and say, would you please do this for me? One gal that was coming to me, she had been married for a few years, and her mother was always calling her to do something. And I said, you're enabling her. She would call her, bring her food 20 miles away from where the gal lived. You know, and then it carried over into when they got transferred up to the Tacoma area, and I was counseling her. And she got to stop that. She said, I don't know how to do it. And it was a burden for her, and it was so hard. And she began to hate her mother over all this. And so I took her through the process of learning how to disengage. Oh, but she'll say she won't love me. I said, let her say it. You know, to say things like that really don't hurt you as much as you think they do. You may not want your parents to say, I don't love you anymore. But if you understand the motivation, then it's not such a big problem. They're using you. What you need to do is stop enabling your mother, because every time she says stuff like that, you get all excited and all upset and you want to do anything she wants you to do because you don't want her to stop loving you. But her motives aren't right. Like the ones the plain of the Ono, remember? We talked about that. Nehemiah went there. Your motives aren't right. So when you enable somebody, can't say no, you're helping them to continue to be ineffective and immature. I can spend a lot more time on that one. Delegating process, first of all, recognize the limits of your capacity. Determine the purpose of the delegation. As a leader, what are the limits of my capacity? Some leaders don't think they have any limits. We all have limits. Determine the purpose of the delegation. Select the person best suited. That makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, make to explain expectations. They need to know, just like with kids, they need to know what you expect of them. Train in all aspects of the project, whatever it is. You see, again, we get lazy in this business. And so when we know we should delegate, you know, it's kind of like, I remember when I was selling insurance years ago, this guy gave me a rate book and said, go sick him. Sick who? You know, I don't know. He had this philosophy that you hire so many agents and you throw them on the floor, on the wall, and the ones that stick are the guys that you want to keep. I mean, that's survival of the fittest, undoubtedly. But what if you had some good ones there? They couldn't stay on the wall, but if you had really encouraged them, built them up, trained them, and give them some instruction on how to handle themselves, what to do, and so forth, tell them about your expectations of them, train them in all aspects of the project, you would not know exactly how good of an agent they might be. How stupid is that? But sometimes that's how we treat people in church. Maintain communication and validation. Make sure you're constantly communicating and validating. There's a section in the book on leadership that talks about empowering and delegating, and that's one of the points. You maintain communication. After you've delegated, you don't just let them go. It's okay, you're on your own. That doesn't empower. That doesn't train. That doesn't encourage. As leaders, as elders and preachers, our job is to equip the saints, you see. And we don't finish that job when we simply say, here's a job, and once the person takes it, we're through with it. It's easy to do that, but that does not delegate. Okay. Differences in leadership models. And we've talked about this, the controlling positional leader. Elders micromanage, and this kind of model, elders micromanage ministry, and the goal setting is a top-down process. This is one of the things the Japanese really discovered was ineffective. It was ineffective for the long haul. They threw this pyramid thing out, you know, where the boss is on the top, elders on the top, then the preacher, you know, and all the members. Ever seen those pyramid things? Yeah, this hierarchy model, you know. And so the idea is, you know, if you're down at the bottom, okay, what's happening with you? Well, not much. You're being ignored. How different is that and the model that Jesus gives us in Matthew 20? Just flip that model totally. The leader's on the bottom, and the workers are on the top. So this is not an effective way to develop ministry. When the elders have to micromanage, they have so many hours in the day. They have so many skills. They have so much time. They cannot do all that. And what do they do with the workers? Discourage them. What do the workers do? They finally quit. And what happens to the hope? Down the tubes. And you wonder why churches aren't growing in that kind of model. The empowering model, the relational leadership model says, elders have oversight, ministry leaders supervise, and goal setting is a bottom-up process. That way the workers now own the ministry. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Because you're not letting the workers grow. You know, when Paul wrote down in Ephesians 4 that we're supposed to equip the saints, that means they need equipping. That means they can't make it on their own without being equipped, doesn't it? If we could just come in the church as members and all of a sudden we're already equipped, you know, sign us up, I'm already equipped. Don't need training, don't need any help. Then fine, but that's not what Paul's saying. He's saying equip them. That means they're not equipped. What do we do to equip? We train them, we encourage them, we develop them, we empower them. That's equipping. If we're not doing that, we're not doing our work as elders. But I don't hear much said about it. We quote it sometimes quite a bit. I don't see much, and I travel all over the country. I don't see too many elderships involved in really hands-on equipping. When I say hands-on, I don't mean dictating. Hands-on in the sense of teaching that the elders will oversee what's going on. That's their responsibility. But the ministry leaders supervise. In other words, if they come up with some new ideas, they present them to the elders. The elders say, they're good ideas. Go ahead, go with it. What help do you need? What resources do you need? What training do you need? And then those ministry leaders then help their workers to develop a goal setting. Now, I've got in that book, I've got a five-step process in doing that. I won't get into it right now unless I have it. I can't remember if I have it on the PowerPoint or not. But this empowers, see, because now the workers feel like, now there's certain kinds of ways of developing workers. And I spent a lot more time in the book on that than I'm going to here. They have to believe in the mission of the ministry. It has to meet their needs to some degree. It has to be something they agree with spiritually and psychologically and so forth. And something they feel like they can contribute. There's certain criterion in regards to how people fit into certain ministries. And I won't spend time on that. It's in the book. But that's empowering. I take brother so-and-so or sister so-and-so and said, you know, I think you'd be good in this ministry. Why? Well, you know, I'm looking at Romans 12 and the gifts there, and you've got one of those. You've got the gift of mercy. And we've got a hospitality ministry or a hospital ministry, whatever, developing. I think you'd be good at that. This gal has been ignored probably for a long time because she's just a new Christian or whatever. All of a sudden, an elder comes up to her and says, you know, I think you'd be good at this. Whoa, you think so? You've just empowered that person by saying it. And now you say, yes, you know, we've got a deacon over here or a ministry leader, and they're setting up a ministry for the hospitals or whatever. I think you'd be good at that. Would you like to try it and see how it goes? Yes, I would. So now you talk to the ministry leader. Says, here's Sister Sue over here. She wants to be involved in that ministry. I think she's got the gift for it. Can I help you in any way in developing her? She wants to come over and talk to you. I'll introduce you to her, whatever. And from that point on, can I help you any more in your ministry? No, I don't think I need any help. No, I'm doing fine. I trust that ministry leader. Otherwise, I wouldn't put him in. As elders, we wouldn't put them in as ministry leaders, but didn't trust them. We wouldn't have a part to play in putting them as deacons if we didn't trust them. Because you've already done that with the deacons. You're working with them individually. When you start up a ministry, sit down and talk to them about their responsibilities. And we're saying, hey, this is your responsibility. I've got a 5-step plan there in the book. It talks about this is your responsibility. You're supposed to oversee this. We'll oversee you. You oversee this. And your job is to get your workers involved, to train them, what have you, to set the goals and whatever. It's a bottom-up process. And I tell you what, that emerges as something that's very powerful. The people own the ministry, and it's exciting. I did a ministry. I was telling Kevin about this. I did a workshop like this. Actually, it was a men's retreat in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, a couple years ago. And to talk about the generational gap here, guys, we had about 60 people there, I think. About half of them were below 35. The rest of them were old geezers like me. Okay? And we went through all of this stuff. They were excited. We were out talking to them. Towards the end of it, the older guys said, well, that's good. It sounds good. Walked out. The younger guys, they were fired up. And they're saying, you know, this is so biblical. We're excited about this. This empowers the workers. This is what we need. Now, is that good or bad? I don't know. A lot of us that are older, we're in traditional ways and all that. Why are the younger people excited about this stuff more than the older people? Is that because they're more liberal? Is that because young people today, well, just anything goes that makes them feel good? No, they were fired up about it because they thought it was very biblical and the right thing to do. They could see the power in it. And so when I left there, I was fired up, you know, because it gets to be a generational thing sometimes. Our young people know this is a need that needs to be fulfilled. They're ready to rise up and do it. And we as leaders in the church can't hold them back. And we do when we become positional leaders. We don't allow them to blossom. We don't allow them to engage. We don't allow them to be empowering as we empower them. I don't know of any one leadership principle that's more powerful than this one right here. Yes, have a hand? Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. Good point. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, first, if they come to me for help, I'm going to help them right off. I'm not going to question them. I'm not going to interrogate them. They come to me for help, and I help them right away. If I don't know them very well, I'm going to help them right away. If I know them already pretty well, I know that they can handle this themselves, and I won't, and I'll tell them that. But if they come to me, and I don't know them too well, they're a member of the church, maybe they're a new Christian, whatever, and I don't know them too well, they come, yeah, I help them right away. But then I observe them. I help them. I have the spirit of help and service, but then I observe them. Can you do this pretty well by yourself? Well, can you? You know, or ask them some questions or find, and observe them after a period of time. I can pretty well figure out that they can help, they can do it themselves. And I am doing them a disservice. And maybe I have to do some teaching along that line. You know, elders got to realize we're teachers as well. And sometimes when we try to help people and so forth, we've got to do some teaching that goes with it. We can't just assume these people understand some things we already know. So there's always got to be teaching. So if I'm helping somebody and I've come to the conclusion, you know, they really can handle this themselves, I'm not going to come around and say, you can really do this yourself. Why are you bothering me? Whatever you want. And I just said, it seems to me like you do a pretty good job on your own here. Oh, no, I can't. And I said, why do you think you can't? Okay, now I'm opening up a dialogue. Once I ask that question, I'm being relational now, aren't I? See, I'm opening up a dialogue. Well, I don't. And then we may spend some time counseling and talking about the Bible and why they feel like they can't. And you know, there's a lot of scriptures that help us in this process. So I think that's the way you deal with that. Any other questions about this? But that's relational, see? That's what we do as relational leaders. Okay, communication requires self-control. Now we get into the anger aspect of this. How much time do we have? Half hour. Okay, anger. Has anybody been angry today? Oh, he's been angry. There's an honest man. There's another honest man. Okay, all right. Got two honest guys in this whole audience today. I don't know. Okay. Did you tell yourself at the time you were angry that somebody else made you angry or something made you angry? Or did you say that? Now, be honest about it, huh? Something made you angry? Maybe you talked to the wife, she made you angry or whatever, or the kids or something? Huh? Other drivers. Oh, yes. All right. Do you need some counseling on rage, road rage? Or, no, I won't. This is a psychological fact. Can you all read this at this level here? I'll write it down and get away from it. This is a psychological law. All anger is a response to a perceived threat. Can you all see that? I taught this to our counselors, and this has become a major focus for dealing with people, because the people that come to us are always angry. Now, if this is a psychological law, and I believe it beyond a doubt, and the threat can either be a real one or imaginary one. In most cases, I'd say probably 75% of the cases we deal with, it's an imaginary one. Has to do with my self-worth, has to do with my status, has to do with how people disrespect me or respect me or whatever, has to do with how I... In most cases, it has to do with how I see my world and I think my world sees me. Now, if it's a real threat, you know, if a hungry tiger is chasing me down the street, guess what? It's a threat. Now, the word perceived is used here not in the sense of that's just how you see it. I mean, that it is in the sense of how you see it. It's perceived. That's what you perceive. Imaginary, you perceive it as a real threat. Okay? Now, in the case of an imaginary one, then if it's a real threat, then I know I'm dealing with that. I'm running down the street, whatever it is. Okay? Somebody's after me, whatever. That's a real threat. Let me give you the example of I'm coming to a stoplight. It's just turning green. I'm getting ready to enter the intersection. The guy's coming from this side, and he's going very, very fast, and he's not slowing down and not pushing on his brakes or anything. And I slam on my brakes, and he just barely goes around me. If he'd have hit me, it'd have killed me. Now, the first thing that strikes me is this is a threat, right? And so fear is one of the first feelings I go through, fear, then anger, because I was almost killed. That's a threat, and I get angry about it. Now, I didn't die, but I get angry about it. That's natural. Nothing wrong with that. It's a true, real threat. Now, 3 months down the road, I watch this happening, this scenario being carried out on TV, and I get angry again. Now, the guy that I never knew, the guy that almost killed me or hit me. I haven't had any situation like that since. He's on his way, on my way. I thought I forgot about it, but no, man, I'm incensed when I watch this same scenario played out on TV. Now, is it a real threat or an imaginary one? It's an imaginary one now, isn't it? How can it be an imaginary one? What is the threat about now? What do you think? Huh? What? Okay. All right. What else? Anybody else? Yeah. Say if I'm paranoid. There's always somebody, you know, CIA's everywhere, you know. This guy tried to kill me and I hadn't slammed my brakes, he would have gotten me. What if I'm really threatened by the fact that I don't get any respect at work? You know, I'm just old Joe, nobody pays much attention to me or whatever. Nobody really cares much about my attitude or my feelings about anything. And here's another example, you know, nobody respects me, you know. I'm in the grocery line at the store, you know, and some guy butts right in front of me, you know. I get this kind of stuff all the time. Nope. It's my view then of the world and how I think the world views me, okay? That's a threat to me now. Or it disrespects me in the sense of my status, whatever. There's all kinds of threats out there, but threats are threats. And I've had people challenge me on this, and we've gone through several exercises trying to prove that something out there that I got angry about wasn't a threat, and they never came up with one. Because if you're angry right now, something caused you to, because you know you believe a lie. This is where it gets interesting. You believe that someone can make you angry. And it's always somebody else's fault. The weather. I have a guy that I used to counsel. Every time we'd get in the fall in Seattle, he'd have to take pills. He couldn't take the gloomy weather, you know. It was a threat to him. He had to take pills to get through it. You see, he believed that somehow he couldn't get through it without a pill. We got a lot of pill pushers out here today that believe that, you know. I got to have something, some mood-changing pill for me to get through the day. You know? Now we got little kids taking mood-changing pills, altering pills, just to get through the day, see? And we got doctors that are passing them out like candy. Don't let me go there because I, good grief. Because I can't. See, I'm lying to myself about what I can and can't do. I'm lying to myself about what makes me angry. I am choosing to be angry. Now, sometimes there's something as a threat to me in my subconscious mind way back. And maybe the brain brings it up, so maybe it's not a choice right that moment, but it was a choice somewhere in my history. I had one gal I was counseling, and I was living in Spokane at the time, and I was counseling her, and she said, every time I go into the old part of town, I'm scared to death. I shake, I tremble, just going to the old part of town in Spokane. I said, well, let's look at your history a little bit. Let's look back. Come to find out years ago, she had misbehaved. Her dad locked her in the closet. They had one of these old houses, you know. It's kind of one of those mystery type houses that, you know, gotta have ghosts. It's just like it's just made for ghosts, you know, whatever. And she's locked up in there all day, terrified, 3 years old or something. And she programmed that in her subconscious mind. She kept thinking about it afterwards and programming. And so finally, when she's going through the old part of town, she sees these old houses. She's terrified. She doesn't know why. She's not making the choice. She's not talking about it. But the brain brings it back up again because it's still there in the subconscious mind. And now she's afraid. You have threats in your subconscious mind that maybe you created a long time ago, had forgotten about them. Then all of a sudden they crop up. It has to do with your self-esteem, your self-worth, how you see your world, how you think the world sees you. And when they crop up, maybe it's because you're interacting with somebody. Or you just happen to be thinking about your job or whatever. And when they crop up, you think, I didn't make that choice. It just happened. No, you made the choice somewhere in your history. It's in the subconscious mind. It's a threat in your subconscious mind, and now it's coming up. Or you're just making that decision today because it seems to be the thing to do. Everybody does it. Everybody says, this guy made me angry, the kids made me angry, whatever. But in reality, you're making the choice. Now, this is a factual truth. You're making the choice. You either made it in the history of your subconscious, or you're making it right now. Because you see a threat there that's not really a threat. But you've created it as a threat. You've created it as a threat to your subconscious. You've created it as a threat to your well-being. You've created it as a threat to you because you think somebody's disrespecting you. So what? So what? See, when I grow as a Christian, I put my trust in Jesus. And I don't have a position to defend. Disrespect me doesn't mean anything. It's not a threat to me. You can all just rise up and say, we don't want anything to do with you. You know, this is the most ridiculous, stupid seminar we've ever been to. Well, it would crush me for a while. So what? Somebody down the road will be stupid enough to invite me anyways. I don't care, you know. whatever. I'm just being facetious. Now, but when you see what I'm saying? I can decide whether something's a threat to me or not. And elders all the time that are in positional kinds of leadership modes always have threats to their position. If it's not a position anymore, if I'm not trying to control people anymore to make me feel good, controllers do things to make them feel good, to make them feel significant. Here we go back to significance again. Controlling is an attitude. Whether you're controlling your wife, your kids, or controlling members of the church, all controllers have a deficiency in their self-esteem and self-worth. And this happens to be their mode of feeling good about themselves. And so they can control people, and it empowers them then. It doesn't empower the person being controlled, but it empowers them. I've counseled a lot of women that are married to controllers. And I've had to help them work with that. And the way that I do that is I said, you disempower the controller. How do you do that? You don't react to him. And what if he's running around the house stomping and controlling? Maybe he's hollering at me. As long as he doesn't touch you, let him do it. You stay under control yourself, and you don't show any emotion that somehow reacts to what he says and does. See, that's what he wants, the reaction. Even if he makes you cry, it empowers him, makes him feel good about himself. There's that sense of empowerment that he has to have. He feels like the only way he can have it is to control other people. Maybe he doesn't fully understand that, but that's exactly what's happened psychologically to the controller's mind. And I've had women try that, and after a while, it's amazing to them about how their husbands finally settled down, took more responsibility. Yeah. I thought I originated. I'm so disappointed today. My goodness. My self-esteem, you made me angry. My self-esteem just went down a notch or two. I learned something in psychology that there's nobody that's originated anything. But anyway. Yeah, but that's right. That's right. And you see, as a positional leader now, I've got to do a threat check. If I'm going to be honest with myself, I'm going to do a threat check. But as a child of God, I really don't have anything that threatens me. And I've got a scripture for that. Matthew 10:28. Can you quote it? Fear not, man who can destroy the body or your self-esteem or disrespect you. I know it's Wilson's paraphrase, but anyway, it has the same point. Fear not what man can do to you. Just fear God who can destroy your soul in hell. Can you do that? Can you do that? That's Jesus saying that, see? No man can disrespect me in a way that destroys me. No man can disrespect me in a way that causes me to lose control. Not anymore. And I teach this in our training with our counselors and with our counseling sessions. Not anymore. Because only Jesus Christ can destroy me. And you can rank on me. You can call me all kinds of names. You can tell me how stupid I am, how lousy a leader I am. You can call me all kinds of names you want to call me. And it may hurt a little bit. But it will not destroy me, and I will not see it as a threat anymore. Because I won't allow people like that to control me. I won't react to it. I may say, I'll pray for you, brother. What can I do to meet your needs or whatever? I won't react to it anymore because I know reacting then supports. If it's a negative reaction, if I threaten them, want to kill them or shoot them, whatever, it's still a reaction that feeds the controller. It empowers them. And so you're just feeding them. You're enabling the controller when you react to those kind of things. You can respond and say something you want to and say, well, I don't agree with that. I'm not going to do that. I tell wives, you can say, I don't agree with that. I'm not going to do with that. And if he jumps up and down, screams and hollers, let him do it. Sit there and say, I've said my piece. I tell you what, it does a number on those those controlling people. I said, as long as he doesn't hit you. If he hits you, you tell him. One more time, I'm calling 911. Period. If you haven't been reacting anymore, he's taking your word for it. Because if he hits you again, they have a tendency to escalate. Don't allow it to happen again. That empowers the wife when you teach them these things. Yes. Well, I'm glad you're here. Sure. Glad to. Glad to. You bet. You see how this principle applies to leadership? I'm going to take you a while to process this because you're not believing it right now, Bob. You're believing that wife of mine made me angry. Those kids made me angry. The boss made me angry. Traffic made me angry. Okay? I've been in traffic for an hour. And I'm getting angry. I can't take it. These crazy people cutting in on me, you know? Who's in control here? You, or you giving the control to people in your life? You want to give them that control? That's what you're going to do when you allow that to be a threat and you react to it. Yes. Step three. Oh, I've got a PowerPoint up here, don't I? I forgot all about that, didn't I? Yeah. See what happens when I get to preaching? Okay, let's look at anger. I'm angry right now. Confirm if it's worth responding to. It may not be. There's some things I get angry at my wife, but it's not worth the fallout to go ahead and do it, you know? You know what I'm saying, guys? Not worth it. Drop it. So you confirm it, or you postpone it. Evaluate how, when, and where to express it. Look for a time when you're settled down and what have you. You express it in iMessages. Instead of saying, you made me angry when you did that. Put it this way. I felt angry because I thought maybe you didn't care. You see the difference in two statements? The you made me angry, that's accusative. Right away, the person's going to be on the defensive. I got angry because I felt like you didn't care. Okay, now I'm taking responsibility for the feeling, you see. I'm not blaming you for the feeling that I have. I can't blame you for the feeling I have because it doesn't work. It's not true. Not only that, but I'm taking control of myself. I'm not letting somebody else control me. Elders have to learn how to do that, don't they? Because too often let members control them. And usually that's a reaction to what they're trying to do to control the members. You see what I'm saying? And so iMessages then just send kind of a message. I'm taking responsibility for my feelings, but I'm letting you know why I feel this way. But I'm not blaming you for making me feel this way. You see what I'm saying? That's the iMessage. That's a little difficult to pick up on this after a while. You got to kind of massage that one. So that's in my Transform Life book if you want to get into it deeper. Okay? Any thoughts or questions on this one? But it breaks down the defenses of the person you're talking to. Non-accusative. An illustration of a posture. Can't talk anymore. Positional versus relational model of leadership. The following diagram reveals, and I'm going to quit with this one, reveals a ministry that reached its peak at 70 in attendance. I was in charge of this ministry many, many years ago. And we started out as, I was a preacher for Lakeview, and we started out, I thought, you know, we got some singles coming, they're kind of building up, the singles groups kind of building up the church, and so we need to do something for them. So I, myself and a deacon, we started having a class on Sunday morning, and that class just kind of built right up, and so we would have some individual home studies during the week. And at the first, we thought, man, this is going great. But what we did was we used the relational model in our approach to these young people. We'd sit down, especially during the week. We would study certain scriptures about self-control and all that kind of stuff on Sunday morning. In fact, it got so big, I had to move out of the church building, go to a school that we rented for a while. And but during the week, we'd have in-home studies, but basically they were share times. It allowed them to share what they're struggling with. And we let the ones who were single only or be in one group and single again in another group. And some of the leaders were a little bit skeptical of this thing, you know, where's this going? This is getting out of control. But we allowed them to share. And so we had sessions where I would guide the sessions, or the deacon would guide sessions, and help them to share what's going on, what they're struggling with. We want to know what you need, what your struggles are. And we went through that for quite a while. That's the relational model. And it grew rapidly in the beginning. Then a positional model, in order to maintain success, began to creep in. And I think I've got the, well, let me go back to that just a second. 36 months, it had died. The ministry died in 36 months. Now, let me show you right here. Okay, now what you see here, and this bell, kind of a bell curve. Anyway, it's kind of a bell curve. And you see down here, we started empowering the people. It got to 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70. In the relational model, it was working well for the first 18 months or so. And we thought, man, this is great. But then all of a sudden, we didn't have as many attending the class on Sunday morning, and we didn't have as many attending in the homes at night. And we thought, wow, you know, it's been so successful. Our model's been so successful that we've got to do something to pressure these people to get back involved. We don't want to change our model because it's been successful. What can be wrong here with the model that we thought was successful? The relational model was successful. So we started putting pressure on the singles to be involved more now And we kind of bugged them a little bit for not attending, and we got a little bit more involved in bugging them, you know, and start preaching to them, putting pressure on them. And it kept going down, you see, because at the peak, we left the relational model and began to incorporate the positional model. And it died a slow death. You with me what I'm saying here? You see what we see here? What we did not do and did not understand was, when it got to that peak, that was the time to change our ministry to meeting their needs in a different way. See, we were locked into meeting the needs through share groups. Well, they'd reached a point, they'd done all the sharing they wanted to do. Now it's time to do some other phase of ministry. But duh, no, we're thinking, hey, that's been a great model. We don't want to change that. Let's keep on with the sharing. And we had some complaints about it, but we thought, yeah, it's been successful. Don't quit. But instead of changing from one relational model to another, we changed from the relational to the positional, and it died. That's the most powerful example I can give you of what I've been talking about this whole day. If we just simply changed, queried, asked them questions about what they needed, telling them about how we wanted to challenge them to do more outreach and stuff like that, they'd have jumped on that like crazy. But we got locked into our success, and it destroyed them, destroyed us. So you've got to constantly, when you're in ministry as a leader, you got to constantly be looking at, where are we now? How are we doing? Is there less interest today? We need to change our ministry. There's nothing unbiblical about that. We're not talking about doctrinal issues here. We're talking about ministry. We're talking about leaders that are tuned in to the needs of the workers and of the people. If we'd been tuned into their needs, we would have made some changes and kept that ministry going. No telling what it could have done. But once it began to die, we couldn't stop it. We kept pressuring them to stop it. And once it died, it's over with. We couldn't resurrect it. Yes. That's okay. It's okay. You need to know their needs. That's the key word. See, what we didn't recognize was the needs of the singles had reached a point where they were very satisfied. They had grown to a certain level where lots of sharing sessions weren't important to them anymore. Now, what we could have done is, as we brought new young people in, we could have had a session for them at sharing. That's good. But the people have been around in the sharing for a while. They wanted to move on. They wanted to branch out into ministry that would reach out in the community. But we didn't buy into that. That was their need. They had reached a point where the needs changed, because maturity changes needs, doesn't it? And we hadn't recognized that. We blindly went along. The success, the pride of the success, got to us. We didn't see the people's needs anymore. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Good point. Very good. Yes. Exactly. I'm going to leave this one with you. I think I'm out of time anyway. I don't know. I'll just leave it open for questions at this point. I feel like there's probably not much need to go beyond this. I won't get into the next segment, but if you come by tomorrow, I'll touch on it for you. Or we'll read a book or something. Yes. Sure. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Does no good at all. Yeah. 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 James Dobson said, hollering at your kids is kind of like trying to drive the car by honking the horn. I like that's a pretty good analogy. Yeah, didn't work. Somebody had up? Yes.
Well, first of all, I think we have to know the heart of God. That's what Nehemiah knew. You know, he knew what God wanted. He knew what was disrespecting God. But our vision, our sense of vision needs to go beyond this congregation. I think it should be brotherhood-wide. But first of all, I think we have to know the heart of God. What needs to be done here that's going to please God and help the church to grow? And because you can have a lot of visions that don't really involve God much, and they wind up being more about you or the institution. We get back into this, don't we, say, is my vision to build the institution? If that's my vision, I don't think it's going to be blessed by God if it's just the institution that we're trying to build. If my vision has to do with people, like here, see, we didn't have the vision to see, we had to make some changes. We had the vision to start going and growing, and we were meeting needs, but our vision was limited. You have to reassess vision. You can get to a certain point where this vision is being fulfilled. Now, what's the next step? But vision says, I'm coming out of my comfort zone. Vision says, I want to do what God wants done. Vision says, I want to do what it takes to build up individual members of the church as leaders. Vision says, I want to do what it takes to help the churches outside this congregation. Vision's always centered on God's will and what you can do to build up the body and build up the church. If it's on anything else, I think it's futile. I think it's too self-serving. I think it's too positional. And so, where are you today? Are you like Nehemiah? He had a vision. I mean, he's in good shape. He doesn't have to have a vision about his congregation or his life. He's in good shape. Those cupbearers were pretty well off financially. Has no problems, no discomforts, no strain, no pain. But you see, he had a vision because he had a heart for God and God's people and God's work. If you don't have a heart for God's people, for God, God's people, and God's work, then visions begin to deteriorate into institutional visions or individual assessment visions. What's going to do for me? You know, and then you lose sight of what a vision is as far as the idea of a godly vision. And so I think you've got to start there. And I think elders got to start thinking in terms of what can we do to build this body up? You know, if it takes some kind of a ministry or whatever, what can we do? But we got to focus on the body, not the institution. Because maybe we need a church building. I'm not against building church buildings, but I'm saying if the church building is your vision and that's it, it's probably going to be a very futile exercise. And we know what people go through with building church buildings. I've had several. When we built the one at Lakeview, it's a beautiful facility and all that, and we were growing and all that, and I had some people say, well, just imagine how much more we can grow once the building's built. When we were going through the building of that building, we stopped growing because our focus was all on the building. And now we're hoping the building is going to do what we should be doing. So the vision got lost. We got institutional in our vision. So, and I think that's where elders really have to guard. If they're in a building program, they have to guard against this institutional vision kind of concept. Get some people to do it. Stay away from it. Don't let the people say, well, I want to vote on the carpet. You know, we got this nasty old carpet. Let's get some, I want to vote on the color. Then fine. Go get people over there that want to take care of the color of the carpet and the color of the... Don't bother with us with that stuff, you know. Go ahead and do it, whatever. But let's not get into the institutional vision, because when we do, I think we lose sight. We lose power, God's power in doing so. But I think you have to have a heart for God. You have to have a heart for God's people. And you have to have a heart for seeing the church grow and do well. And if that's not important to you, if that's not a motivation for you, then probably you won't have the kind of godly vision we're talking about. And I don't think Nehemiah had sat around, wherever he was housed. I don't think he sat around the capital or whatever, thinking about this and thinking about that. You know, he woke up to the fact of the need, and it wasn't to give anybody glory or whatever. It's only to give God the glory. But he saw a need. Our tendency sometimes is that when we think we see a need, it's more for our glory than it's for God. Or we try to say it's for God, but it's not really so much. So it's just to have that kind of heart. And sometimes we have to get together as elders and leaders and sit down and say, what are we doing today that builds up the body and pleases God? What are we doing? And how can we do that? And then start getting some ideas and brainstorming and whatever that we can do to do that.
And then eventually bring the members of the congregation involved in that as well. They're getting excited about that. What can we do? Let's talk about brainstorming. I mean, I know most of us, if we have elders, we despise business meetings. Okay, I understand that. And we try to avoid them, you know, like the plague. But there are times you need to bring the congregation in, and like we were talking about going small groups. We brought the congregation, sat down, talk about it. We brainstormed, we threw it all around, get all everybody out there with what they thought about it, didn't think about it, or whatever, before we've made a decision. And so I think that's very important to do that. But first of all, you as a leadership, you have to sit down and say, what can we do to build this body? I don't care so much about the church building or not. What can we do to build this body up? What can we do that's outside of ourselves that God can bless? Something along that line. As leaders, you got to think that way. Good question. Anybody else? I don't know if I answered your question, but that would be what I'm saying. Yes. Yeah, he didn't have to see the complete vision because, well, his brother came back and designed, he pretty well described everything, so he had a vision there. But our vision can be somewhat limited in the beginning. You know, what can we do? Our congregation's stuck. You know, if you're not saying it's dying, you're saying it's at least it's treading water, and you can't stay that way very long. Any eldership that are godly leaders realizes you can't stay in this treading water state very long. You start losing members. You're not empowering people. You're not doing God's will. I mean, there's a whole host of reasons why. It's self-destructive to stay in this type of state, you know, where you're just treading water. So if you feel like this is what happened in the Puget Sound area. I was feeling that way. I felt other churches were feeling that way, but I wasn't sure. But I thought, you know, get two elders together and ships together and start talking about it. Boom, right away, people say, yeah, we get that sense that we're just dying here. We're just treading water. The churches aren't growing. We're not together. We're not in fellowship. We don't talk to one another. And they began to see that. And so a vision began to develop from that. Then we're contacting other churches and elders, and they're saying the same thing. And all of a sudden, we got people jumping on board. I had a church just yesterday I found out about, pretty good-sized church, and I hadn't even talked to them yet. I talked to their preacher. They're so excited about it. They say, where do we spend the money? You know, that's a vision. And now it's getting more of a vision that we can see now. Where it's going to go, I don't know. That's God's business. But if this comes together and we have this workshop, where's it going to go? I don't know. But I know one thing. I've learned a lesson from this. Whatever changes we have to make it more effective in reaching people's needs and reaching the lost, that's what we're going to do. And we'll meet together and we'll talk about it. Where are we now? Are we losing the impact of what we want to do? Are we still on our vision? Do we have to expand our vision? That's the kind of thinking you have if you're going to be a visionary. Yeah. Anybody else? Well, thank you for hanging with me this long. My goodness, it's almost 3:00. Love to sit there, and I don't mind ranting and raving if you don't mind listening to me, but anyway. I think we're tired, so I know there may be some of you want to come up afterwards and talk to me. I'll be glad to do so. I will be right here. I'll turn it over to Richard. Thank you, brothers, so much. Thank you.
Thanks again, Ken. You've got to be getting ready for a little bit of a need for a rest as well.
I'm feeling my age a little bit, yeah.
It's just great to be together, just be together as brothers today, and to have our minds centered on our calling in the church, whatever area of leadership or ministry or service that we're involved in right now. And we just appreciate the time in the Word and hearing from you. Thanks so much. And again, welcome to all you brothers. Thanks so much for coming from far away, and we wish you Godspeed on your way home. And Mike Ray, one of our elders here, will come and lead us in a word of prayer as we close.
Let's pray. Our loving Heavenly Father, we are so thankful for this day and the opportunities that you presented to us to be able to be here as your children and to hear your word so aptly taught. And we're so thankful for our brother Ken Wilson and men throughout the brotherhood who have his abilities and knowledge and is willing to share his time to share it with us so that we can be more knowledgeable about to be better, more effective leaders and able to lead bodies that we are involved with, and that your church will grow throughout our communities and throughout the world. Thank you, Father, for all the blessings that you give us in this life and the intellect that you give us, that we have the ability to understand and to develop our thoughts and to put those thoughts and words to action, to be doers of your word and to take it to the lost wherever they might be. Pray, Father, that you'd be with our brothers that have traveled here from distances, that they might have a safe trip home, and be with our brother Ken Wilson, that he'll have a safe trip home. Thank you again, Father, for watching over us and holding us up and forgiving us when we fail you. And it's our prayer, Father, that we will be stronger because of this time that we've had together. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.